Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up later in the program today, we talk to the head of the Vatican's Office for Consecrated Life and discover some little-known facts about this mission of the Church. But first, Jill Bevilacqua takes a look at the Gospel reading for this, the 16th Sunday of the year, in her program, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Let's listen.
Jesus proposed to the crowd another parable. The reign of God may be likened to a man who sowed good seed in his field. While everyone was asleep, his enemy came and sowed weeds through his wheat and then made off. When the crop began to mature and yield grain, the weeds made their appearance as well. The owner's slaves came to him and said, "Sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? Where are the weeds coming from?" He answered, "I see an enemy's hand in this." His slave said to him, "Do you want us to go out and pull them up?" "No," he replied. "Pull up the weeds and you might take the wheat along with them. Let them grow together until harvest. Then at harvest time I will order the harvesters, first collect the weeds and bundle them up to burn, then gather the wheat into my barn."
After our Lord's explanation to the disciples of the parable of the sower, which we heard in last week's Gospel, he recounts yet another on the theme of sowing the seed. But while the first parable is recounted by Matthew, Mark and Luke, this one is only told by Matthew. In four separate versions, the man in the parable sows good seed in his field. But what the enemy sows is described differently in two of the versions. Our version and that of the Revised Standard Version calls them simply weeds. In the Vulgate, however, we find them specified as cockle. And this, we may read in a dictionary, is the name of a plant which grows in cornfields, also called corn cockle. Look this up in a book of wild flowers, and here is its description.
Wandering through or round our cornfields any time during summer, one is almost sure to find this beautiful flower. It's an annual, tall and erect, the stems clothed with white hairs and attaining a height of 4 or 5 feet. The leaves are long and narrow, and not unlike the leaves of the corn plants surrounding them. The flowers are solitary, of a rich purple within, much paler without, and measure nearly 2 inches across. The flowers produce nectar, but owing to the length of the tube, it's only accessible to the long tongues of butterflies and moths, who are instrumental in effecting its cross-fertilisation.
Can this beautiful flower possibly be the iniquitous weed of the gospel? Not so. Take a look at the Jerusalem Bible, and you will find that the enemy sowed darnel among the wheat. And what is darnel but a deleterious grass, Lolium temulentum, which grows as a weed among corn? And a quotation from a certain H. Barrow reads, "Satan sowing his darnel of errors and tares of discord." And to sow darnel, the dictionary tells us, is to sow dissension or discord. No doubt about it, then, darnel was the weed the enemy sowed. And in his Story of the Gospels, Piero Bargellini traces the history of the Italian word for darnel, zizzania, and adds an explanation.
Zizania. It's a word of Semitic origin, known to us only from this passage of the Gospels. From the Aramaic it passed to the Greek, and from the Greek to late Latin, and it survived in our language solely because of the Gospel story. It's a ruinous plant which grows in the fields, mixing in with the corn, which it resembles, at least until the latter produces shoots. Thus it takes room and nourishment from the useful plant. Moreover, its seeds contain a poisonous substance and would be dangerous for humans if it were ground into flour together with the corn. That's why it's one of the most insidious parasites of corn, and why the word zizania has become proverbial as a synonym of discord, disagreement, enmity.
Well, there seems to be no uncertainty about this weed. But What is a weed? Asked the 19th century American poet and essayist Ralph Emerson. And he answered his own question, saying, a plant whose virtues have not been discovered. Darnel seems to have no virtues, but other weeds have often revealed surprising qualities. Didn't St. Columba thrive on nettle broth? Fumitory was once held to have great medicinal value. Feverfew was the classical and medieval world's aspirin and is still used by migraine sufferers. Comfrey as a poultice for bruises, dandelions as a diuretic, tormentil for stomach pains and toothache. One could go on. And today, herbal medicine is a thriving rival or alternative to conventional drugs. But in Shakespeare's time, a weed was a weed. And when poor, maddened King Lear is reported to have been seen wearing them as a crown, his daughter Cordelia comments sadly.
Alack, 'tis he. Why, he was met even now as mad as the vexed sea, singing aloud, crowned with rank fumiter and furrow weeds, with burdocks, hemlock, nettles, cuckoo flowers, darnel, and all the idle weeds that grow in our sustaining corn. Search every acre in the high-grown field and bring him to our eye.
Writing in the late 18th, early 19th century, George Crabbe in The Village deplored the ruin of the countryside where all was overgrown and abandoned.
Where the thin harvest waves its withered ears, rank weeds that every art and care defy reign o'er the land and rob the blighted rye. There thistles stretch their prickly arms afar and to the ragged infant threaten war. There poppies, nodding, mock the hope of toil. There the blue bouglas paints the sterile soil. Hardy and high above the slender sheaf, the slimy mallow waves her silky leaf. O'er the young shoot the charlock throws a shade, and clasping tarries cling around the sickly blade.
What a picture of desolation. Crabbe was clearly ignorant of the many healing qualities of mallow, from soothing cough mixture to ointments for burns. Like many things, weeds may be positive or negative in their influence, and the positive seems often to be discounted. As Hopkins pleaded, long before we became so conscious of our dwindling natural world.
Oh, let them be left, wildness and wet. Long live the weeds and the wilderness yet.
And before we leave the weeds, let's listen to these pensive lines from The Garden by Vita Sackville-West.
Consider these with thankfulness and wonder, nor ever ask why that same God, if it was he who made the flowers, made weeds. The thistle and the groundsel with their fluff, the little cresses that in waste explode, mistaken bounty at the slightest touch. The couch grass, throwing roots at every node, with wicked nicknames like its wicked self, twitch, quitch, quack, scutch. The gothic teasel, tall as hollyhock, heraldic as a hallbird and as tough, the romping bindweed and the rooting dock, the sheeny celandine that Wordsworth praised. He was no gardener, his eyes were raised. The dandelion, cheerful children's clock, making a joke of minutes and of hours, ironical to us who wryly watch. Oh, why, we ask, reversing good intentions, was nature so ingenious in inventions? And why did he, who must make weeds, make flowers?
After he had recounted the parable of the good seed and the weeds, Jesus told two others to the crowds gathered on the shore of the lake. One about the mustard seed, smallest of all seeds, but so great when it has grown that the birds nest in its branches. The other about leaven hidden by a woman in 3 measures of meal till it was all leavened. These 2 little parables are explained by a scholar as emphasizing the contrast between the humble, insignificant beginnings of the kingdom and its ability to grow up to a final tremendous result. Jesus didn't stop to explain the 2 mini-parables, but, writes Matthew, he left the crowds and went into the house. This, we assume, was Peter's house in Capernaum, where Jesus often stayed. And there the disciples immediately ask him to explain the parable of the good seed and the weeds.
The sower of the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world. The good seed is the subjects of the kingdom. The darnel, the subjects of the evil one. The enemy who sowed them, the devil. The harvest is the end of the world. The reapers are the angels.
The separation of the good and evil, then, will only take place at the final judgment. Till then, good and bad seed will grow together. This, comments a scholar, is another disconcerting aspect of the kingdom, the coexistence of good and evil people, and the long-suffering of God. And an interesting observation is made in a reflection on this gospel by Father Giuseppe De Luca. He points out that the word used to describe the action of the enemy is, and he quotes the Latin, super seminavit, he oversowed. In our version today we read that his enemy came and sowed seeds through the wheat. The Jerusalem Bible has his enemy came, sowed darnel all among the wheat. And the Revised Standard Version also uses among. In the Vulgate version alone we find this enemy came and oversowed cockle among the wheat. So the bad seed is sown on top of, in between, all among the good, inextricably, so closely that to wrench out the bad would inevitably damage the good. Pull up the weeds, and you might take the wheat along with them. Let them grow together until harvest, says the owner of the field. As for the enemy, writes De Luca, while we sleep, God's old adversary comes, and unable to undo God's work and take from our soul what God has sown in it, he sows his own seed in our soul, and goes off. We don't even notice. We don't even think of the devil. We sleep on. We sleep, but there is an enemy who doesn't, the devil. How can we expect no weeds to appear in our poor field? Sobering thoughts. Here we all are, good and bad together, all intertwined, with all the inherent risks this proximity brings. And yet, comments De Luca, we take no precautions, we are not on our guard, when we have the best means of being on guard, prayer. And now let's just listen to a short poem by Lawrence Binyon called Sowing Seed.
As my hand dropped a seed in the dibbled mould, and my mind hurried onward to picture the miracle June should unfold, on a sudden before me, hanging its head with black petals, rotting and tainted, stood a flower, dead. As if all the world's hope were rotting there, a thing to weep for, ripe for burial, veined with despair. Yet I cannot prevent my ignorant heart from trust that is deeper than fear can fathom or hope desert. The small, twy-bladed shoot will thrust to brave all hazards. The seed is sown, and in earth I trust.
The sower in this simple poem, having planted a seed, is brought up short when he sees the dead flower. But despite this depressing sight, with its message of rotting hope, the man places his trust in the earth and hopes for the miracle. When we pray, we place our trust in God, who sowed the good seed, which the enemy is incapable of rooting out. Long ago, God told Satan, I shall put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. For while Christ is the sower, he is also the seed. As the scholar said, the seed is the word made flesh and crucified. Finally, as a biblical scholar writes,
the explanation and comment Jesus makes on this parable point out its religious value. Good and evil are interwoven in history. Therefore, we must share the patience of the owner of the field of the world, in other words, God, and await the fullness of the story of humanity.
They're the glue that keeps the church together. The religious and lay people who consecrate their lives to Christ and bear witness to his love through ministry and charity. When most people think of consecrated persons, they think first of religious men and women. But some of our listeners might be surprised to learn there are other forms of consecrated life, such as consecrated virgins and consecrated hermits. Well, I asked the Secretary of the Pontifical Congregation for Institutes of Consecrated Life, Archbishop Joseph Tobin, what sets consecrated people apart from the rest of the faithful.
Like any vocation, to be a consecrated virgin or a hermit or a Jesuit or a sister of charity, a daughter of charity, ultimately traces its root to the divine impulse, you know, to the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And the church as sort of the custodian of God's gifts and helps consecrate people who feel this impulse to live it in syntony with the gospel and with the Catholic tradition. So to say that a hermit is a member of the consecrated life, yes, I think that, you know, that stretches it a bit. What is difficult in that case to always understand is the community dimension, because a hermit by definition...
He's someone who pulls himself away from society.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. But we do, these are ancient vocations in the church. I mean, the vocation to hermit. In fact, St. Anthony began his life as a hermit, as someone who lived apart. He sold all that he had and provided for his younger sister, which was good of him, and then went out into the desert of Egypt. And there were other people who sort of felt drawn by the example of his life to accompany him. And so... the hermit was no longer a hermit. Instead, he had a community of men around him that were, and then later women, who followed his example.
Now, it was Pope John Paul II who instituted the World Day for Consecrated Life back in 1997. In his homily for the very first celebration on February 2nd that year, he said, "The observance is intended to help the entire church to esteem ever more greatly the witness of those persons who have chosen to follow Christ by means of the practice of the evangelical councils, and at the same time is intended to be a suitable occasion for consecrated persons to renew their commitment and rekindle the fervor which should inspire their offering of themselves to the Lord." Now here we are, 2011, that's some 14 years later in a very changed world. How do you think Pope Benedict sees this World Day for Consecrated Life?
Well, I think he appreciates the inspiration of his predecessor. I think that it's important to look at the original inspiration of Pope John Paul II, that this was not simply for consecrated people, but it's for the church. And it's to remind the church of the presence of this particular vocation, which he judged himself. I think if you read some of his own writing, especially the apostolic exhortation Vita Consecrata, that he saw it as something quite important and, one would even say, essential for the church's life. So I think the celebration of February the 2nd was first and foremost for the church, to remind the faithful of the beauty, the importance of this vocation.
Now, Pope Benedict himself has likened consecrated life to a plant with many branches, which sinks its roots into the gospel and brings forth abundant fruit in every season of the church's life. But he's also called consecrated men and women a bridge to God for all those he or she meet, a call and a return. What is the Pope, do you think, expecting of the faithful here and the consecrated?
Well, I think that of the consecrated life, I mean, I like his example of a plant. I mean, I often speak of it, of the consecrated life as a whole, because in my service to the church, I deal with all a variety of forms of consecrated life, from monks to teaching religious, to missionaries, to people who live a contemplative or life that is in some way separated from the world. I think of taken together, it is a sort of ecosystem. And like the Amazonian rainforest, it's essential to the larger system of the church. Without that rainforest, we would find it very difficult to breathe, because it provides oxygen for the world. And I think in some way the consecrated life should provide this oxygen for the church, part of it, in drawing on that second, about the bridge example, is to illustrate the importance of God before all else. Because I think if you want to find the common denominator among religious, it's that. I mean, that whatever their particular work may be or their service, pastoral service, it's first and foremost a recognition of the supremacy of God, and that everything that we are is conditioned by that. And so that perhaps the freedom, the joy, the hope that we religious find in pursuing our vocation and in recognition of the supremacy of God will also help married couples, single people, young people find joy and freedom and really the correct direction in their own lives.
You know, Pope Benedict also pointed in some of his discourses to cloistered communities as being united to Christ's passion. And this is just one quote from Pope Benedict, taking on themselves the sufferings and trials of others and offering everything with joy for the salvation of the world. But in today's age of 3-second sound bites, iPhones, YouTube, Twitter, some might think that cloisters or these cloistered communities would be passé. Are they?
Well, I don't think so. And I think most of the brothers and sisters that I know that live that particular lifestyle wouldn't think so. Especially the younger members that are attracted by the, I suppose, the depth that one finds in a cloister. Now, the depth is a recognition that reality isn't simply a superficial or passing fad.
I think, and also this Pope reminded us of the importance of silence in our lives. In this world, it is so noisy. So we're bombarded with so many images and sounds. The importance of silence.
I think you're right. And he reminds us in very practical ways, like his own practice and really expectation that other celebrants follow the practice of, after the gospel, of just being quiet for a moment, you know, to allow the word of God to resonate and speak within us. We are surrounded by a lot of words. And I remember once reading in a manual of management that said, formerly, a practice was to withhold information so you could guarantee your importance in a structure. Now it's simply to bombard people with words, and then no one really knows what's important or not. And I think that silence can help us understand and witness to the one thing necessary.
Now, people were shocked by the clerical abuse, sex abuse crisis, and revelations that the leader of at least one institute for religious life had seriously compromised his vows and the trust of his followers. And here I'm thinking in particular of the Legionaries of Christ. The faithful, many young seminarians and priests have felt, quite frankly, betrayed by those who they once trusted. To what extent have these scandals taken a toll, do you think, on vocations in the church? And do you think enough has been done to purge this behavior from the church and ensure that it never happens again?
Well, there are several questions there. I mean, the first regards scandal. And, you know, Jesus was very, very, used very strong language about scandal, because I think he knew in his compassionate heart just what damage can be done. The people of this city recognized it millennia ago when they started, had a proverb that said, corruptio optima pessima, the corruption of the best is the worst. And that's exactly true, because it leaves people cynical or dubious regarding the authenticity of anybody who tries to do good things. Now, I think in that sense, religious and priests across the world, in my experience, have been touched and hurt by the scandals such as the one you just touched upon, because all of us feel a bit suspect, you know. I've also found that if people know us, and they eventually will form their own judgment about whether we're the real deal or not. And I think that the church, both locally and universally, is making serious efforts and progress to ensure that, to the best we can, that scandals don't occur. I don't think we can give 100% guarantee, because finally people are free, and they're free to choose very evil things. It's my belief, and I'm by nature an optimist, that people don't go out of their way to choose evil. And however, I do believe that religious leaders have a special responsibility to offer a witness that's transparent in all senses of the word. And when we don't do that, the price is very severe. Now, I'm glad to see that, you know, I can speak, for example, of some dioceses in the United States. I understand where there were some very public and damaging scandals, that the vocations to the diocesan priesthood and some religious institutes has not disappeared. I mean, in fact, it's recovered and seems to be going well. But that's not, I'm not Pollyanna. I don't think that, I think that some very severe wounds have been inflicted on the church, and I think the Holy Father is one of the first to recognize that.
Pope John Paul II suggested that consecrated people not only, and these are his words, have a glorious history to remember and to recount, but also a great history still to be accomplished. He said, look to the future where the Spirit is sending you in order to do even greater things. And Pope Benedict, too, is urging people, it seems to me, to rekindle the enthusiasm for the faith that the first Christian communities enjoyed. And this in a world today where religion is more and more seen as a source of conflict or of division. From here, then, what future for consecrated life?
Well, I you won't be surprised if I tell you that I agree with both pontiffs there. I think the words of Pope John Paul that you quoted to conclude Vita Consecrata are a very salutary reminder to religious who, at times, looking at the limited horizon of their, of this moment of history, may feel very discouraged. And I think they're with reason in some contexts. What are the reasons for hope? Well, I think the reasons for hope is that this finally religious life or consecrated life isn't simply a human project. It isn't that the founders like St. Ignatius Loyola or St. Francis de Sales or Dominic or Jean-François de Chantel or any of them sat down and said, you know, I think it's a good idea to found a religious order. It was the impulse of God. It was the work of God in giving a gift to the church. And that's what charism finally means. It's a gift. So to conclude the consecrated life is over, I mean, you'd have to say, well, then God chooses not to give gifts to the church any longer. I mean, this is a gift among other gifts. And so, yes, and I think there are very practical possibilities for the service of the consecrated life to the church and to the world. For example, you mentioned about the marginalization of religion and the growth of division. Well, consecrated life is a reality that goes beyond national borders. I mean, many of the really thriving religious orders and congregations today are multinational groups, multicultural groups. And they're groups that, in my mind, prolong the miracle of Pentecost. Not simply that the good news is heard in all, you know, in everybody's language, but that the good news doesn't require people to forfeit the richness of their own tradition or their culture. And so while it's not always easy, I think at our best, we reflect a Catholic church in a microcosm. That a religious order or religious congregation, while very attentive to the local circumstances, is a reality that also witnesses to the God who loves and enters all of human reality.
And a very warm thanks there to Archbishop Joseph Tobin, Secretary of the Pontifical Congregation for Institutes of Consecrated Life. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.